Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participant lines are in the listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Janitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update on peripheral T-cell lymphoma. It's a very important program, and we're delighted with your response to our program today. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you. We have on the call today over 452 participants, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities. You come from suburban areas as well as rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Bangladesh, Canada, China, and the United Kingdom. So you truly come from all over the world. It's a bit of a global call. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline our speakers have prepared. There is information about all of the different collaborating organizations with their websites and telephone numbers, toll-free numbers, so that you can contact them. And there also is, of course, an evaluation form. And I would ask you all to take a moment at the end of our program today and complete that evaluation form. Who but each of you can best tell us the programs, the topics that you would like us to offer in the future? This is the beginning of a new year, and we very much want to actually hear your feedback so that we'll be able to kind of implement your suggestions. We try really hard to put those programs into place that you would all like us to offer. Now, today's program is supported by an unrestricted educational grant to Lymphoma Research Foundation from Allos Therapeutics, Inc., and we really want to thank them for their support of this vitally important program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. Is Dr. Owen O'Connor. And Dr. O'Connor wears many hats. He's Professor of Medicine and Pharmacology, Deputy Cancer Center Director for Clinical Research and Cancer Treatment, NYU Cancer Institute. He's also Chief Division of Hematological Malignancies and Medical Oncology, NYU Langone Medical Center. Dr. O'Connor is also here, back by popular demand, and he is going to start off the program and cover overview of peripheral T-cell lymphoma, its biology and pathology, and current treatment options. Dr. O'Connor?
Well, thank you very much for the introduction, and sorry for the long titles and all the time it may have eaten up, and welcome everybody this afternoon. I'm here in New York, so I recognize it could be morning wherever you are. There's been a lot of excitement over the recent years with regard to the T-cell lymphomas, and I think that when you look at a lot of the more uncommon forms of blood cancers and lymphomas in particular, diseases like myeloma and mantle cell lymphoma, we have, in a very, very short period of time, made enormous strides in understanding these otherwise very rare entities that have been historically very poorly understood. And I want to really emphasize the point that it's an understanding of biology that's actually led to marked improvements in treatment, the discovery and development of new drugs that are in very short windows of time changing the natural history of all these diseases. And now the T-cell lymphomas have their turn. These diseases, even 5-10 years ago, were extremely very poorly understood. We did not understand a lot about the diversity of these different lymphomas. The lymphomas, by way of background, are all diseases of lymphocytes. And these lymphocytes are actually born in the bone marrow. They come from stem cells that are reside in the bone marrow and give rise to all sorts of other cells like white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets. The white blood cells, of course, come in a whole variety of flavors, lymphocytes being one common variety of white blood cells, myeloid cells being another variety of which neutrophils are a very common representative. But the lymphocytes are the cells that actually become malignant in lymphoma. What's been interesting over the years is that if you look back 50 years, maybe a little bit more, we only recognized 4 or 5 different types of lymphoma. When we look at non-Hodgkin's lymphoma today, we actually recognize over 65 different diseases, and these diseases are very, very complicated. The lymphocytes that I mentioned earlier, a kind of white blood cell, actually themselves come in a whole variety of flavors. They come in the form of something known as B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes. B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes play a very important role in your immune system and are really important in monitoring and developing immune response to infectious diseases, whether they be bacterial infections, whether they be viruses or fungi. The T cells, the normal T cells in the body, actually play a very important role in fighting viral infections, and they're oftentimes the cells that are responsible for graft rejection of solid organs. So patients who have transplants, for example, might who are at risk of rejecting a lung or a kidney, that rejection by the host immune system is mediated by T cells. So these diseases, B lymphomas and T cell lymphomas, are actually very, very different types of diseases. Now, for all practical purposes, all these lymphomas, B or T, come in 2 big flavors, and those flavors are aggressive or indolent. The aggressive lymphomas are typically diseases that grow, as the name suggests, fast. And these diseases usually require some form of treatment, usually in the form of chemotherapy, to get them under control. The indolent lymphomas are diseases that typically grow very, very slowly. And these are diseases that may or may not require treatment just because you have the disease. Typically, the paradigm is in lymphoma that those fast-growing lymphomas tend to be diseases we can sometimes cure, and those slow-growing diseases are diseases that we can oftentimes rarely cure, but oftentimes manage for long periods of time, sometimes even for decades. Now, the T-cell lymphomas also come in a whole variety of different diseases, and depending upon what classification system you want to look at, there may be 20 or so different types of T-cell lymphoma. When we think about T-cell lymphomas and as patients think about these diseases, we can sort of think about them with regard to the different compartments of the body that they grow in. So, for example, there's a whole variety of T-cell lymphomas that grow almost exclusively in the skin. We call these cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, and in fact, there's a whole variety of different T-cell lymphomas that grow in the skin. There's one variety called mycosis fungoides. That's one of the more common. And there are other varieties known as CD30 positive or anaplastic large cell lymphoma of the skin. These are typically very, very indolent diseases that can sometimes just be watched or sometimes be managed with things as simple as topical therapies. Another way to think about the lymphomas is to think about those T-cell lymphomas that actually grow in lymph nodes. And in that category are lymphomas like peripheral T-cell lymphoma, not otherwise specified. That's the most common form of T-cell lymphoma. And there's another variant known as anaplastic large cell lymphoma that also tends to grow in lymph nodes. Interestingly, the anaplastic large cell lymphoma subtype of T-cell lymphoma tends to be a highly treatable and, in fact, highly curable form of T-cell lymphoma. There are other variants that actually can grow in tissues that are not lymph nodes and not the skin. So T-cell lymphomas have this notorious reputation for growing in the gastrointestinal tract, sometimes growing in the nasal sinuses, sometimes growing in the spleen or the liver. And these types of extranodal presentations oftentimes define the specific subtype of T-cell lymphoma. Lastly, some of these diseases can grow in the blood, and we refer to them as the leukemic forms of T-cell lymphoma, and they include diseases like these virally associated adult T-cell leukemia lymphomas that are commonly seen in Caribbean, sub-Saharan, and Asian populations. So that's sort of a general summary of the biology and pathologic considerations of these diseases. And it leads us then to the more complicated topic of what do you do if you have T-cell lymphoma? So obviously what you do depends to a great extent on just what kind of T-cell lymphoma do you have. If you have one of those variants that are indolent, maybe living only in the skin, and maybe they just present as a small rash, those are diseases that may or may not warrant treatment, and again, oftentimes the treatment is very simple. But for the majority of the other T-cell lymphomas that are growing in lymph nodes or in your blood or those extranodal sites like your gastrointestinal tract, those diseases oftentimes tend to grow fast, and they're diseases that really require some form of chemotherapy to get them under control. We'll talk about the whole variety of different chemotherapies, but there are many, many different chemotherapy regimens. And one of the problems with the selection of the chemotherapy for these diseases resides in the fact that these diseases are incredibly rare. So when we talk about all of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, there's about 64,000 cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma per year in the United States. But if you remember what I said in the beginning, there's 65 different types of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. That means for many different kinds of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, there may exist as many as 500 to 3,000 or 4,000 cases of those diseases per year. The T-cell lymphomas, in general, represent about 10% of all forms of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So the B-cell lymphomas are very common. T-cell lymphomas only represent about 6 to 10,000 cases per year in the United States. 15 to 20 different kinds of these diseases would then tell you that most of these different subtypes of T-cell lymphoma are in fact rare. And it's because they're rare that doctors do today for most of these diseases don't have hardcore data that they can rely on to say, yep, this is the absolute right treatment for the disease. Doctors today were trying to actually figure out what's the right therapy for all these different diseases. So what is the most common chemotherapy we use for these diseases? It tends to be something called CHOP-based chemotherapy. Why CHOP? Mostly because CHOP was used and found to cure many patients with aggressive forms of B-cell lymphoma. So CHOP wasn't really developed as a chemotherapy that had this remarkable activity in T-cell lymphomas. It was developed as a therapy with very good activity in B-cell lymphomas. And as we began to see more and more different types of T-cell lymphoma, its use was simply extrapolated to the use of patients with T-cell lymphoma. Most specialists in the management of T-cell lymphoma will tell you today that CHOP is not the best therapy. The problem with that is that we really don't know what is the best therapy. So it's easy to be very critical of CHOP, but we also are at a bit of a stalemate because we don't have hardcore data to say what's better. And this is the issue you're going to hear later from Dr. Shustov, which is what's probably going to be better down the road is the identification of lots of new drugs. And right now we're living in one of the most exciting times for the management of T-cell lymphoma in that we have many, many new drugs for these diseases. And I'll touch on one or two in a moment. So one of the other big issues related to the current treatment recommendations for T-cell lymphoma have to do first, what's the best chemotherapy regimen to use up front to manage these diseases? So again, I mentioned to you, CHOP is probably the most commonly used, though a regimen many of us are not very happy with. There are other regimens, something called EPOC that's been developed by the National Cancer Institute seems to be a commonly used regimen there, and there are some subtypes of the disease where it seems to work well. Regimens called hyper-CVAD have also been shown to be very, very active. So there are many, many different regimens. It is impossible for any one person to say that regimen A is better than regimen B, is better than regimen C. We simply don't have that data. But what's exciting, as I alluded to earlier, is the fact that we now have drugs that seem to be earning their own stripes in the treatment of T-cell lymphoma, and that includes drugs that are independently demonstrating significant activity in patients who failed many conventional chemotherapy regimens. So one example of one of those drugs is called pralatrexate. It's a drug that we helped contribute to the development of while I was at Sloan Kettering and Columbia, and it actually, in September of 2009, became the first drug ever approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration for the treatment of patients with relapsed and refractory peripheral T-cell lymphoma. And this drug by itself, in patients that have seen many, many different types of conventional therapies, in fact, patients who've seen more than three different types of combination chemotherapy, the response rate in that population was was about 30%. And importantly, in that population, it responded for a long time. Now, 30% may not sound like a lot to a patient sitting at the other end of the phone call, but that 30%, you have to remember, is occurring in patients who've probably seen about 8, 9, 10, maybe 12 different conventional chemotherapy drugs. So the players that we put on the field in terms of the ones that we have the most faith in right now are a lot of these conventional chemotherapy drugs that we're pulling from our understanding of the management of B-cell lymphoma. But a drug like pralatrexate, able to produce responses, including complete responses, in 30% of patients who've seen lots of other chemotherapies, is in fact very, very promising, and means that if we can move that drug up from patients who have multiply relapsed disease and try to move it into the front line, there is a possibility and a great potential that we'll be able to develop new platforms for the treatment of the disease that might be better than CHOP. Now, the last issue I want to touch on is the issue of bone marrow transplantation, and this happens to be an area of expertise of my distinguished colleague, Dr. Shistov, out at the Fred Hunch Cancer Center. So I will only touch on it in brief because this is something he's really a very well-known expert at. And transplants come in two big flavors, autologous, where we use stem cells collected from yourself, or allogeneic, where we use stem cells collected from other people. But in terms of the management of patients with newly diagnosed T-cell lymphoma, there is a bit of a controversy raging, and that is, should we be performing stem cell transplants in all patients that have T-cell lymphoma when they're first diagnosed? Meaning, if I use something like CHOP chemotherapy and I get you into a complete remission, is that a good time to consider a bone marrow transplant? And so for years, people thought, no, let's wait till the patient relapses and then try the transplant. And what we've learned over the years is that doing autologous stem cell transplants for patients with multiply relapsed disease may or may not be associated with the best use of that technology, meaning it does cure many patients. But increasingly, many, many physicians are becoming enamored with the idea of using the stem cell transplant in first remission. So when we use the CHOP chemotherapy, if we can get you into a good complete or partial remission, that may be the optimal time to use stem cell transplantation. And there's now a variety of different data sets that seem to suggest that possibly moving the transplant earlier in the management of the disease may be associated with better outcomes than using it later in the game. An allogeneic transplant, which you'll hear Dr. Shistov touch on again as well, is another technique that is now reserved for patients who have relapsed disease that's become resistant to conventional chemotherapy. And there is a lot of exciting data that seems to suggest that an allogeneic stem cell transplant, which takes advantage of the graft versus lymphoma effect, those donor stem cells that are now growing in the patient's body, actually lead to the development of an immune system that's able to fight the lymphoma, and that's called graft versus lymphoma effect. And that's the prominent feature by which allogeneic stem cell transplants work, and that happens to be an area that's rapidly growing, and I think an area that a lot of bone marrow transplant physicians have a lot of faith will help change the natural history of these diseases in patients with relapsed or refractory disease. So with that in hand, there's a lot to talk about, and 15 minutes is a very short amount of time to do it. But my colleague, Dr. Shistov, will pick up and tell you a little bit more about some of these new treatments and a little bit more detail about the role of bone marrow transplant for T-cell lymphoma.
Thank you very much, Dr. O'Connor, for really doing a wonderful presentation and really setting the stage and the overview and providing all this information for everybody. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Andrei Shistov, and Dr. Shistov also wears many hats. He's Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology, University of Washington School of Medicine, and Research Associate, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And Dr. Shistov is going to talk about new treatment approaches, the role of bone marrow transplant, and clinical trials. Dr. Shistov?
Thank you very much for a nice introduction, and thank you for inviting me to participate in this conference. Good morning and good afternoon to everybody who is dialed in, depending on which part of the country you're in. I want to thank Dr. O'Connor for excellent presentation on biology and diversity of T-cell lymphomas, at this time, I will take on and try to tackle a topic that is not an easy one to discuss, new therapies of T-cell lymphomas, role of autologous and allogeneic transplant in T-cell lymphomas, as well as what do we have in the pipeline, what kind of clinical trials we have available for patients with this challenging disease. First of all, I would like to echo what Dr. O'Connor just mentioned, that while CHOP therapy is used most widely in a community setting and has shown wonderful results for patients with B-cell lymphomas, we started to realize in the past 5-7 years that it might not be working as well for patients with T-cell lymphomas. That spurred significant interest and in conducting clinical trials and specific research in T-cell lymphomas. And we are very happy to see great advancements in the past 4 or 5 years. I have to make an exception here, though. As Dr. O'Connor has mentioned, anaplastic large cell lymphoma might be the only exception from the rule. And patients with this particular diagnosis, especially those who have a ELK1-positive anaplastic lymphoma, do exceptionally well with standard CHOP therapy, and majority of these patients will be cured with frontline treatment with this regimen. Outside this particular diagnosis, most of the lymphoma specialists believe that we have to depart from CHOP as a standard backbone for a frontline treatment as well as constructing clinical trials. In terms of frontline treatment, we do not have a very good idea yet what should be the preferred regimen, which drugs are the best to combine to treat patients with newly diagnosed T-cell lymphomas and NK-cell lymphomas, natural killer cell lymphomas that are grouped together under this umbrella. In my practice, and many of my colleagues have adopted the strategy where we look at the clinical trials around the world. They might be smaller trials. Some of them are have studied as few as 15, 20 patients, but gave us some idea of the single-agent activity of certain chemotherapy agents. And even though they were not specifically tested in combination for T-cell lymphomas, it certainly makes sense to adopt them into clinical practice because CHOP, again, is not very exciting. I will just mention a couple of chemotherapy drugs that we believe are active in T-cell lymphomas more than just standard CHOP therapy. There is a chemotherapy drug called gemcitabine or Gemzar that has been specifically tested in a small study in T-cell lymphomas, both cutaneous and systemic T-cell lymphomas that Dr. O'Connor has described, and has shown very promising results. And we are now testing in the laboratory and in the clinical practice combination of this chemotherapy agent with other drugs to see whether we can come up with a reasonable combination that will beat CHOP in treating T-cell lymphomas. In my own practice, I personally use a known combination combining gemcitabine with a couple other chemotherapy agents, the regimen called GVD, even in frontline treatment. And GVD stands for combination of gemcitabine, vinorelbine, and Doxil. And by the way, Doxil is a very special chemical form of well-known drug doxorubicin that is part of the CHOP that also has been tested in a small clinical trial in both cutaneous and peripheral T-cell lymphomas and showed presumably high activity than regular doxorubicin. So I do believe that combination of gemcitabine and Doxil is a very reasonable combination to consider in a frontline setting. It is a well-tolerated regimen, and in fact, this GVD regimen has been tested in a variety of lymphomas by a large cooperative group in the United States, so we have very good safety data of this treatment protocol for patients with lymphomas. I would also mention that the huge randomized trial was conducted several years ago by a German high-grade lymphoma group, and it compared standard CHOP therapy with CHOP with addition of the drug called etoposide, so-called CHOEP regimen, C-H-O-E-P. And this large randomized study included patients with both T and B cell lymphoma, so it is very hard to say whether T cell lymphomas benefited the same as B cell lymphomas, but by and large, the results were slightly better in CHOEP arm of that study than CHOP. And one can extrapolate this to treatment of T-cell lymphoma in younger patients because this regimen is certainly more toxic than CHOP. But the etoposide, again, many of the T-cell lymphoma specialists believe that is it is an active drug in this disease. The infusional version of this regimen was mentioned by Dr. O'Connor is EPOC, developed by our colleagues at NIH, Dr. Wyndham Wilson. It is a safer way to deliver this combination and might be more efficacious way. We don't know this yet for sure, but certainly GVD, CHOAP, and EPOC provide some alternative to CHOP for patients with T-cell lymphomas if they do not go on clinical trials. I will start emphasizing at this point that participating in clinical trials with either newly diagnosed T-cell lymphoma or relapsed T-cell lymphoma is of paramount importance because we still, again, do not have a well-established way of treating these diseases that everybody agrees on. Now, in the salvage setting, when lymphoma has relapsed after initial therapy, Dr. O'Connor has mentioned we now have a very exciting new agent, pralatrexate, termed Folatin by the maker of this drug that has shown remarkable activity, in my mind, in a very specific and very difficult disease setting. I have to say here, though, that still a standard approach to treating younger patients or patients in a decent health is consideration of autologous stem cell transplant, and I'll mention in a minute. However, having pralatrexate as a salvage option or the option when many other treatments failed as a first approved drug is very, very exciting. I would also encourage patients and their families to look into upcoming data on another experimental at this point for T-cell lymphomas drug called romidepsin. We have just recently completed the large international trial with romidepsin in peripheral T-cell lymphomas. We do not have any data on response or duration of response yet, but I think it will be an exciting new agent because it has shown very good activity in cutaneous T-cell lymphomas and, in fact, was approved as well in September of 2009 to use in cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. So the data on romidepsin in peripheral T-cell lymphomas is very eagerly awaited. Now, I will briefly mention the anecdotal studies and small trials that have attempted to apply interesting biologic drugs for salvage in patients with T-cell lymphomas, again, when they failed multiple lines of therapy. First drug I will mention is called Campath. It is a monoclonal antibody, the immune molecule that attacks the tumor cells using immune mechanism. It has been tested very extensively in Europe and predominantly in disease called T-cell prolymphocytic leukemia. It has shown very significant activity in this subtype of T-cell malignancy. It has been tested briefly in small number of patients in peripheral T-cell lymphomas with some interesting responses, and it might be one of the options when, again, not everything else failed and patients are searching for another line of therapy. I have to emphasize, though, that this agent is very immunosuppressive and has to be used by somebody who is familiar with its toxicity, and I personally think this is a drug that should be used by academic physicians. It's very difficult to apply in a community setting because of the infectious disease prophylaxis necessary for these patients. The other agent I will briefly mention is ONTAC. It's a very interesting biologic molecule that combines a natural biologic agent, interleukin-2, that we all have and we use in our immune system to fight infection. And it is fused to a toxin from diphtheria, from whooping cough. So this immunotoxin has shown very high activity in cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. Again, this drug is approved for cutaneous T-cell lymphomas and is being tested either as a single agent or in combination for peripheral T-cell lymphomas. But it is available and might be an option for patients with relapsed refractory disease when everything else fails. Finally, I will mention a drug called Velcade. Or bortezomib that is approved to be used in multiple myeloma and mantle cell lymphoma, subtype of B-cell lymphomas in the United States, and has shown very exciting results in vitro and in small studies in peripheral and cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. I have to make a statement here that all three drugs mentioned, Campath, ONTAC, and Velcade, were not approved for use for T-cell lymphomas, and these are preliminary data. But these agents are available and could be considered in a drastic situation. I will emphasize again at this point that the best option for both newly diagnosed T-cell lymphomas and relapsed T-cell lymphomas would be searching for available clinical trials, because nobody knows yet how to best treat these diseases, and you as patient might gain access to very exciting new agents before 2, 3, 4 years before they become available. I will go ahead then and address the issue of stem cell transplant. I had the privilege of being trained and work at one of the most renowned transplant centers in the world, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, and we do a lot of transplants every year. I have particular interest in transplanting patients with T-cell lymphomas. As Dr. O'Connor has mentioned, it is a no-brainer that in patients with relapsed disease, autologous stem cell transplant is the only modality that has shown that it can cure patients with relapsed disease. And it remains the standard of care for this situation. Again, if patients are capable of tolerating aggressive chemotherapy and their disease is sensitive to chemotherapy, in other words, they achieve response to salvage treatment. I would like to mention that the utility of autologous transplant is expanding, and there are some very exciting clinical trials that are incorporating new agents as a part of the transplant. I will mention at our center we have very interesting development using radio-labeled antibodies or antibody immune molecules that are fused with radiation that specifically target T cells in this setting, and we are awaiting results of this study very eagerly, and the study is actively accruing. Now, in the newly diagnosed disease setting, or primary therapy, what we sometimes call it, it is much more controversial. In the past couple of years, we have learned from several clinical trials that it might be a very good strategy for patients with newly diagnosed disease. The problem interpreting these studies as scientists, as physicians, and counseling our patients is that these are studies that were never controlled by non-transplant population, non-transplant patients. So everybody on these studies was transplanted. So we cannot really say with certainty that transplant is any better than not transplant patients in the situation when they achieve complete remission after CHOP, CHOEP, or other therapies. But the numbers certainly look very promising. I will mention that the Nordic study recently has accrued a lot of more than 100 patients who were transplanted, and their numbers look very, very encouraging. Once again, I think it will take a larger clinical study as a cooperative effort between different institutions to really prove definitively that this strategy is more beneficial than just chemotherapy. Just to touch on the idea of autologous transplant, the mechanism there is that we are giving patients much, much higher doses of chemotherapy that is frequently combined with total body radiation in attempt to kill every single lymphoma cell in their body, and then we have to salvage the patients with their own stem cells that we collect prior to treatment. So the idea of autologous transplant is high doses of chemotherapy. And sometimes this approach is called high-dose therapy with stem cell support, because technically it is not a transplant. We're not transplanting organs or bone marrow from somebody else. As opposed to autologous transplant, allogeneic transplant is really a very sophisticated immunologic therapy. In this case, patients still receive very high doses of chemotherapy, though, so they still have to be able to tolerate this type of treatments, be fairly younger, usually younger than 60 years of age, and be in good health. But then instead of their own stem cells, they will receive stem cell product or bone marrow product from somebody else. And the whole idea of this approach is immunologic therapy. The new immune system, the new stem cells that come from somebody else, are supposed to attack the residual lymphoma cells that the patients have and kill them off. So in a way, we use an immunologic mechanism. Certainly, allogeneic transplant comes with a lot of challenges. It is much riskier than autologous transplant, but we certainly weigh risk-benefit ratio in certain situations, and when patients have used up all the available modalities, it becomes a very viable option. I will also mention here that we have recently developed in our institution an approach called mini-transplant that allows us to take patients to transplant even in their mid-70s and patients who are not so healthy. So this is very, very exciting new strategy, mini-transplant for T-cell lymphomas. We have also tested this in other hematologic cancers, and we are awaiting this data being published in the next couple of months. Finally, I will mention that for certain types of T-cell lymphomas that Dr. Arcana has mentioned, specifically so-called nasal type T-cell lymphoma, hepatosplenic T-cell lymphomas, intestinal T-cell lymphomas, adult T-cell leukemia lymphoma, if you or one of your family members was diagnosed with these diseases, these patients definitely should be considered for allogeneic stem cell transplant in first remission because these diseases remain very, very challenging. Finally, I will go very briefly over the available clinical trials in the country. And just to mention most exciting agents, to my mind, that all of you have to be aware. First of all, for primary therapy, the cooperative group called SWOG, Southwestern Oncology Group, is looking for patients for a very new chemotherapy approach. It is called PEGS protocol, P-E-G-S, and it combines completely different drugs from CHOP. Secondly, for relapsed and progressive disease, there is a very exciting study that is run by Dr. Horvitz at Sloan Kettering, which is a spin-off from the initial pralatrexate study and is a very good option for patients with relapsed T-cell lymphomas. It combines pralatrexate with a drug that I mentioned, Gemzar, and this study is available in multiple centers in the country. So I would encourage patients and their families to inquire about the availability of these studies from their primary physicians. I will mention that on the tail of Romidepsin trial that we have recently finished, we now have another exciting biologic agent from the same group called Belinostat. The study is open in multiple centers in the country, and I think it is a very good option for patients with relapsed refractory disease. I will also mention that I'm personally very impressed with the upcoming new agent specifically for anaplastic large cell lymphoma. It is called SGN-35. It's a very active drug so far, very preliminary data in patients with anaplastic lymphoma. And this study is also accruing in multiple centers in the country and is looking for patients, again, with this specific diagnosis. Finally, I will again mention that in the realm of autologous stem cell transplant, we have just recently activated a very interesting study with antibody fused to radio-labeled antibody. It is fused to a radioactive iodine, and the initial results with this are very, very encouraging. And I will finish again bringing the topic that if you or your family members are diagnosed for the first time with T-cell lymphomas or T-cell lymphoma that has come back after initial therapy, please seek second opinions because it is a rare disease and patients in the community, physicians in the community would see maybe one or two cases per year, and it is a very challenging diagnosis to make, and treatments are still controversial, and seeking second opinion from academic centers is very, very important, and always inquire about clinical trials because we do not yet have established standards of care for this disease, and you might benefit from having access to very exciting new agents that otherwise will not be approved for several years. And I will finish here for the sake of time and take questions.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Shastra, for a very excellent and very informative presentation. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. I'm just very interesting and just remarkably helpful information to everybody on the call. We have two more speakers before we take questions. Our next speaker is Jennifer Mills. Jen is an oncology social worker, and she's National Director of Patient Programs, Lymphoma Research Foundation. And Jen is actually the moving force for today's program. She really, as all of you who may know Jen, she really is just remarkable in helping to make these programs possible. So I want to turn the program over to my colleague, Jen, who actually wants to say some words of welcome and to tell you about the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Jen?
Thank you, Carolyn, and thanks to CancerCare for the partnership and collaboration on this call. LRF and CancerCare have been partnering on this teleconference and similar teleconferences for many years, and we truly thank them for their collaboration. We also extend our deep appreciation to Drs. O'Connor and Shustoff for their time and energy dedicated towards this teleconference. In the midst of their very busy academic careers, both physicians significantly contribute to lymphoma-specific patient education initiatives throughout the year, and we thank them for their ongoing passion and dedication. On behalf of the entire Lymphoma Research Foundation, we also thank Aleph Therapeutics for their unrestricted educational grant. Without their support, this teleconference would not have been possible. I'd just like to take a moment to share with you a little bit about the Lymphoma Research Foundation and what we can do for you. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest lymphoma-focused voluntary health organization devoted exclusively to funding lymphoma research and providing patients and healthcare professionals with critical information on the disease. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. To date, LRF has funded over $37 million in lymphoma-specific research. LRF also provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for patients, survivors, and loved ones, including our Lymphoma Helpline and Clinical Trials Information Service, where our trained public health and mental health staff can assist you with your search for lymphoma-specific information and many of the clinical trials that Dr. Shostov mentioned on today's call. We understand that looking for clinical trials can be an overwhelming and daunting process. This is why we are committed to conducting individualized searches based on your specific diagnosis and present you with options to review with your physician. LRF also offers a Lymphoma Support Network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who've had similar lymphoma-related experiences. This can be particularly useful for those of you diagnosed with rare types of lymphoma who may have not met someone with their specific disease yet. We also offer a wide range of publications and newsletters, including comprehensive disease-specific booklets for non-Hodgkin lymphoma, Hodgkin lymphoma, and a new publication on CLL and SLL. We have a wide range also of disease-specific and treatment-specific fact sheets, including numerous newly developed T-cell-specific fact sheets, and a wide range of newsletters and online materials. LRF also offers webcasts on specific types of lymphoma, treatment options, and support topics. There are now over 70 webcasts available on our website, and 20 new programs were just released in December for your viewing. In addition to these virtual programs, LRF also offers in-person patient education conferences on the regional and national level throughout the year. For more information, please contact a member of our helpline staff at 800-500-9976 or visit our website at lymphoma.org. Thank you, and please remember that LRF is committed to providing you with the most up-to-date information on all subtypes of lymphoma, including peripheral T-cell lymphoma. Thank you, and I look forward to the questions.
Thank you very much, Jen. Thank you for your wonderful words of welcome to everyone. And our next speaker is Richard Dickens. Rick is an oncology social worker. He's program coordinator of blood cancers, project coordinator, mind-body program for cancer care. And Rick will say some words about welcome and also will actually describe a bit about cancer care services. Rick.
Thank you, Carolyn, and hello to everyone. I appreciate the educational and expert advice of Drs. O'Connor and Shostov. I really, it was a very informative presentation today that I myself learned a lot from, and it's always a pleasure to partner with the Lymphoma Research Foundation and to hear and share a Connect workshop with Jen Mills. Thank you. For peripheral T-cell lymphoma patients and their families, there are numerous issues related to treatment which can impact your quality of life. Concerns about treatment, insurance, jobs, or who will help you with loved ones during treatment are common questions. Changes brought on by treatment can affect sexual and body functions and challenge most people's self-image, eliciting feelings of sadness, anger, fear, and frustration. At the same time, what is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless, scared, and sad as well. The good news is that at some point, the whole cancer process will become familiar to you, and you will develop what is often called a new normal. Accepting that changes are normal during treatment can go a long way toward nurturing your body, mind, and spirit, and help you maintain an enjoyable quality of life. During these times, it is often helpful to seek the help of a social worker or other healthcare professional from organizations such as Cancer Care. At Cancer Care, along with these Connect workshops, we offer financial assistance toward transportation to treatment and some limited grants toward treatment costs. We also provide regional face-to-face groups as well as national telephone and online support groups for patients and those who care about them. Most important, at Cancer Care, we provide the opportunity to speak with an oncology social worker who can help you identify people and resources in your community to address your needs as they arise. Cancer Care has been around for over 60 years. All our services are free. To many, support groups and social supports go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenge of cancer, but daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. You can visit our website at www.cancercare.org, or to speak to a social worker, you can call 1-800-813-HOPE, which is 4673, or email us at info@cancercare.org. I wish you all the best.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, for an excellent, excellent presentation and overview of our services. And now we have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board, and she's going to explain to you how to queue up for questions. And now's your chance to ask questions. Ask away. Trinitha?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Kathy B. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. My question is, I was diagnosed with angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma in March of 2003, had R-CHOP, failed, then had rice and an auto transplant in March of 2004, about 100 days after that relapsed, and then was on cyclosporin from August 2004 to July of 2007.
Kathy, your question?
Yeah, my question is, I have an elevated IgM right now. I'd like to know the significance of that in terms of the lymphoma. And if things were to become unstable, what would you recommend for treatment? Thank you.
Well, actually, okay, well, thank you for that question, Kathy. I'm going to ask Dr. O'Connor to address your question in a general way, and then we hope that he'll provide some guidelines that you can take back to your treating healthcare team. So, Dr. O'Connor, could you address that?
Sure. So this is probably the second most common form of T-cell lymphoma, and again, a relatively rare disease with little consensus about the best treatment programs for the disease. And as your case sort of is testament to, conventional chemotherapy wasn't actually the thing that produced the best response, hence our comments about finding therapies better than CHOP. But you did respond to an immunomodulatory agent known as cyclosporin, which is immunosuppressive. And this represents an emerging new concept in how to manage angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma. The significance of the IgM is typically this would be a disease in which we would consider this not to be a biomarker of the disease. IgM is an antibody made by B cells in the body and is intended to be used by the body to help eliminate bacteria from the blood and other tissues. The particular significance in angioimmunoblastic is that oftentimes with angioimmunoblastic lymphoma, you can have the emergence of a second lymphoma known as a B-cell lymphoma. So it's not uncommon that patients with angioimmunoblastic lymphoma could develop a concurrent B-cell lymphoma. The production of antibodies is something that's exclusively done by B-cells and not T-cells. So measuring IgM is typically important in monitoring some types of B-cell lymphoma, and in a patient with angioimmunoblastic could signal the possibility of a concurrent B-cell lymphoma. So that's something that I would have your oncologist evaluate. In terms of treatment, if you asked five doctors for what they would do next, you would get eight different opinions. And the answer is there is no standard of care. We do have a drug that was just approved, and in fact, as I mentioned earlier, the first approved drug for patients with relapse and refractory T-cell lymphomas, and that's Folitin, and that is a drug that has demonstrated some activity in this particular subtype of T-cell lymphoma and would be reasonable. Other agents that do appear to have activity would include gemcitabine-based therapies, as we heard about from Dr. Shustov. Clinical trial-based therapy would probably be my recommendation because there are so many new drugs and we have so much to learn. And since there is no obvious standard for the disease, my particular recommendation, if available, would be enrollment in a clinical trial.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And Kathy, thank you for asking our first question. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Tracy S. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I was diagnosed with peripheral T-cell lymphoma, stage 1E, unspecified 3 years ago in my first trimester of pregnancy. And I'm wondering if there's any information out there in relation to pregnancy and the lymphoma, whether the pregnancy was a cause or just a coincidence, and also the risk of relapse with a future pregnancy. And I am in remission at this time.
Thank you. Excellent question. Dr. Shustov, can you address that?
Sure. This is a very unique situation, and I actually personally had two patients who were diagnosed with T-cell lymphomas during their pregnancy. I'm not aware of any specific data to suggest that different hormonal changes during pregnancy would contribute to lymphoma development. And I think that research should be done in this area, but we do not have answer for this. As far as treatment lymphomas in pregnancy and other cancers in pregnancy, it is a very challenging topic, but the biggest message here is that it is possible without losing your pregnancy. Usually we try to avoid any chemotherapeutic agents in the first trimester, and in general the second, especially third trimester therapy is very safe for the baby. And I have treated, again, two patients who were pregnant with very aggressive chemotherapy regimens in the third trimester with successful deliveries. As far as recurrence with subsequent pregnancies, it would be a clinical judgment statement. And, again, we don't have any data on this. I do not think that there is any correlation between pregnancy at this time, known correlation, and occurrence of T-cell lymphomas. I would also say that treatment and outcomes of early-stage T-cell lymphomas, and that's what you had, appear to be, at least based on some reports, fairly close to B-cell lymphomas, and meaning that the prognosis for this should be very, very favorable. That's, I think I addressed a couple of questions that were brought up.
Excellent. And Ashley Tracy says, excellent question. And also we'd like to talk with you after the call because, and I'm going to ask Rick to comment on this, but, you know, certainly during when cancer occurs, other things are happening in one's life, and it's really sometimes very helpful to get some support because you're dealing with so many things at once. Rick, do you want to comment on that? It probably comes up a lot in the counseling sessions.
Well, and definitely, yes, getting counseling support, just normalizing your feelings and concerns, but also helping guide you to possible resources such as this Connect workshop or other doctors, but also helping you learn some techniques to deal with the stressors that are the result of having a cancer diagnosis, not only the cancer diagnosis, but in this case dealing with it while you're also dealing with the joys of a pregnancy. So there are some unique features there. There are definitely organizations that we're familiar with that we could direct you to regarding some of those issues, and the psychosocial supports that you can get from an individual counseling session, as well as perhaps joining a group. We do have a wonderful young adults program here for people in their 20s and 30s. So those are perhaps some options that cancer care can offer.
Thank you. So I hope that's helpful, Tracy, and excellent question. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Tom M. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I have been diagnosed with anaplastic large cell lymphoma, T-cell type, ALK1 negative. I'm 68 years old. I went through six-cycle CHOP last year, and I've been in remission since April. My question is, if I should relapse, would pralatrexate be an appropriate avenue to pursue with my background, or should I consider a autologous transplant?
Well, Tom, thank you very much for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Shustov to address your question in a general way, and then you'll take his information back to your treating healthcare team for some help and kind of figure out what's best in terms of tailoring it for you specifically. Dr. Shustov?
Sure. So the anaplastic T-cell lymphoma, as mentioned, I think, by myself and Dr. O'Connor, comes in two flavors. There is so-called ALK1-positive lymphoma and ALK1-negative lymphoma. We know for sure that ALK1-positive anaplastic large cell lymphoma has excellent outcomes, and patients who achieved complete remission after initial CHOP therapy have very, very good prognosis, and majority get cured. The outcomes with ALK-negative disease is not as the cure rate is not as high, but based on our recent research, a very large project completed by a lot of T-cell lymphoma experts in the world called International T-Cell Lymphoma Project actually suggested that even ALK-1-negative anaplastic lymphoma might have a better prognosis, better outcome than other T-cell lymphomas. So I would be optimistic for patients who have anaplastic lymphoma, either ALK positive or ALK negative, and have a bright outlook. Now, if disease were to come back, once again, my personal philosophy is that participation in the open clinical trials is the best option. And depending on the response to the salvage treatment, whether it's participation in clinical trial or other types of aggressive chemotherapy, if response is obtained, then again the standard would be to consider autologous stem cell transplant and high-dose therapy because, again, this is so far the only known way of curing relapse, both T and B-cell lymphomas. Now, in particular situation, the allogeneic transplant should be considered, but there are a lot of variables that physicians and transplant physicians put into consideration, so I'm not going to go into those. But the simple answer would be yes, if a person is eligible for transplantation, either autologous or allogeneic, that would be an answer. And how to get there, the options would be clinical trial versus standard salvage treatment, and I am certainly in favor of people participating in clinical trials because that's where we derive benefit from novel agents, from new drugs that generally are not available.
Excellent. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Judy Q. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I had a rash last year in February and went to see my oncologist, and I came back with clonal T cell receptor gene rearrangement in my peripheral blood and my bone marrow. But all the biopsies on the rash have not shown T cells, and so I've not been clinically diagnosed with CTCL. I was wondering, I have swollen lymph nodes. Should I have those biopsied instead?
Thank you. That's an excellent question, Judy. Dr. O'Connor, could you address that question in a general way, and then we hope that Judy will then take that back to her treating healthcare team.
Sure. So I'm going to make a couple of points. First is many T-cell lymphomas commonly have as a side effect of the disease the development of rash, which may or may not represent the presence of malignant disease. So patients with T-cell lymphoma, the first thing you'd worry about is that the rash might be related to infiltration of the skin by the lymphoma, an unusual and peculiar feature of T-cell lymphomas, but in some cases it may not be the lymphoma. The key to your particular case actually resides in the details of the pathology. And the diagnosis of T-cell lymphomas is actually one that causes pause for many experts in hematopathology. And in fact, if you take one sample and show it to 10 different hematopathologists, pathologists specializing in the diagnosis of blood cancers, they may only be consistent in the generating the same diagnosis 50% of the time. So what I would recommend is, yes, I think that the way to make the diagnosis here is to obtain tissue. That's always the right answer. But the second aspect is you need to have that tissue interpreted by pathologists who are very, very expert at looking at the disease and probably the world authority whenever there's cases like this that need adjudication, referring it to Dr. Elaine Jaffe at the National Cancer Institute, who's considered to be the foremost authority, and she is a common national treasure in terms of someone who does this routinely for physicians both in the private sector as well as the university setting.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Really excellent. I want to thank our speakers for just really being outstanding and very informative. I also want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked such wonderful questions. Your questions really have enhanced our program today. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour education program and that we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I want to remind all of you about all the services that you can access, both from the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care and all the other organizations that are listed in the materials you have from Cancer Care. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I do not want anyone to feel that they're alone in coping with their cancer. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support that you have places to call who will help you and that will not cost you anything. We are here to offer you support, the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and all the organizations listed in your materials. These are free services and free support. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the program. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.